I'm going to come back to the Holocaust for a minute. Somebody says to me, you know, it's not a question of faith, and therefore it's not that important, and since it can, to say that it was untrue is can be so shocking to many people, it's not wise to mention it because it will put people off. I totally understand that argument. On the other hand, I think that it is actually of considerable importance in people's minds. I think it's a domino that knocks over a whole lot of other dominoes. Once you can get somebody to believe in the Holocaust, you can influence his whole view of the Second World War, you can influence his whole view of 20th century history. It's an element which strongly pushes people's minds in a leftwards direction, I would claim. Just like evolution strongly pushes people's minds in a leftward direction. I do think those are the twin pillars in the popular mind. They're the twin pillars of secular humanism. Look at the importance that I mean, there are now programs in all of the schools about, there are Holocaust memorials built everywhere and programs in all the schools. For the people who promote it, it's very important. And the people who promote it are not friends of the church. That's for sure and certain. So the people who promote it are getting a lot of mileage out of it. They must be, otherwise they wouldn't still be promoting it like the way they are. So there's a grave problem lurking behind it. And I honestly think, I can be wrong, but I think that while there are some people undoubtedly who will just switch off the whole thing if they think that the Holocaust is being denied, that just disqualifies the whole of the rest of the, anything said about the encyclical is ridiculous. On the other hand, I think that there's some people who, if they hear the Holocaust being denied, hey, yes, this, here's somebody who's in touch with reality. Because I'm absolutely persuaded that the reality of the evidence is against that particular story. 6 million Jews being deliberately gassed is a myth. It's a mountain of lie built on a molehill of truth. That's what I do believe, by the evidence, by the sheer hard evidence. Okay, and I do think it's a myth that needs to be pushed out of people's minds. Every myth needs to be pushed out of people's minds. Every gross untruth needs to be pushed out of people's minds. Our Lord says the truth will make you free, and the truth about Darwin will free you from the fear that you are descended from monkeys. To learn that our evolution is not scientifically true liberates you from a whole weight, a whole dead weight of misery, miserable thinking about who we human beings are. And to be liberated from the myth about 6 million Jews being deliberately gassed liberates you from a whole dead weight on a number of issues concerning the 20th century, I do believe. It's difficult because the whole movement of public opinion as created by the media, as flowing out of television and so on, the whole movement is undoubtedly in line with 6 million Jews having really been gassed. And therefore you've got to start thinking that they weren't deliberately gassed, that there weren't 6 million deliberately gassed. Actually, there wasn't even one deliberately gassed. To start thinking that is to have to start swimming against the stream. It's to have to start thinking for yourself big time. And it's to have to start renouncing the religion, the religion of secular humanism. So saying, yes, I think it's almost a religious belief. But that's, all of that is opinion. I agree it's a controversy which maybe doesn't need to be raised, but, which will disqualify you in many eyes if you do raise it. You will be disqualified as an anti-Semite, for instance. You're automatically anti-Jewish if you deny the Holocaust. Well, I don't know how many Catholic seminary rectors have ever invited a Jewish rabbi to speak to the seminarians in the old days. I don't know how many, of course, the new fashion rectors, though they will invite them in to teach the theology. But old-fashioned Catholic rectors, there will have been very, very few that invited a rabbi in to talk to the seminarians, but I did. Years ago, I'm not necessarily boasting of it, but I suggest it's an indication that I certainly don't have a distaste for Jews as Jews, which is the only reasonable definition of anti-Semitism, to automatically dislike Jews simply because they're Jews. I also invited a Jewish mother. I mean, you know, gosh, a mother of 9 children. She's Catholic by religion, but Jewish by race. A Jewish mother to speak to seminarians. So, you know, it doesn't exactly suggest that I'm an anti-Semite. I don't think I am. But I don't like enemies of God, enemies of our Lord. I don't like those people who do their very best to yank souls away from our Lord. And I'm afraid that amongst the people who do that today, there are many Jews. Amongst the people who are yanking the whole modern world away from our Lord, there are many Jews. Those people I don't like, not because they're Jews, but because they are enemies of our Lord. So, let's come back to Deuteronomy. The subject, the practical consequences. Society by consent denies the sociality, the natural sociality of man, and it takes away any strength from authority, because it brings authority down to the human level where you've got humans and humans. There's no real authority there. Authority must come from above. So, on the contrary, society by the authority of God establishes authority and dignity and majesty. If a person, if the ruler, if the subject senses that in the ruler is not just a human being, but a representative of God, he's got a much better motive and a much better reason to obey. And it's much easier for him to obey if he sees in the rulers representatives of God. That's the reason. And such is the clear and weighty teaching of the two princes of the apostles, Peter and Paul, in the books of scripture. Both say to obey the authorities. Paul notably, I said in Romans, beginning of Romans 13. However, there's an objection. Oh no, there's not an objection. There's a very interesting paragraph for today, 15. The fact that the authority of man does come from God means that when men command something that is obviously not from God, there's no authority behind it. Let's do that, represent that with an image. If here is the prince, the man in authority, be he a president democratically elected, be he a king, be he an aristocrat, makes no difference. Here are the subjects. Here are the rulers and here are the ruled. Now, this ruler's authority comes from God, who is the God of all of these creatures. And his authority comes from God, and therefore he has authority to rule these. And his authority goes as far as, goes to the limits of what is in line with the will of God. But if this man, this ruler, tries to give that command, he's going outside the authority that he's getting from God, and he has no authority. Therefore, if the rulers make a law defending abortion, these subjects don't have to obey. These subjects obey him because he's under God. One republic under God. There you have a republic under God. That's the right way to think, obviously. But he's got no authority to command these things. And these subjects have no obligation to obey those things which are clearly outside of the authority that comes upon the ruler from God. And so obedience has its limits. And Archbishop Lefebvre, exactly parallel, did not have to obey Paul VI when Paul VI tried to tell him that he must celebrate the new mass. Because it was against, the new mass is outside the will of God, it's outside the authority that Paul VI had. Similarly, when the Archbishop was told by the Pope not to consecrate bishops, which is a similar, the Archbishop, he has not got authority to stop me protecting the faith. He has not got authority from God to forbid the necessary defense of the faith, the necessary protection of the survival of the faith. And that's why the Archbishop quote-unquote disobeyed. But if you refuse to obey one of these orders, if a subject refuses to obey that order, it's not real disobedience. He is obeying God, and he's only disobeying man. He's not disobeying God. He's obeying God rather than obey man. This is to obey man. Anything here is to obey God. And so a ruler has all authority within his office, whatever authority he has, and within the will of God, there he has authority. But outside the will of God, against the will of God, he in no position of authority can he have authority to do that. And so this subordination of man's authority to God sets limits to obedience to men. Obedience to men is limited by obedience to God. I can't obey men in such a way as to disobey God. Because the men cannot have authority to command them is something that's outside the will of God or against the will of God. And so to bring God into it, firstly, makes the ruler more sober because he's got to fear his judgment. He's going to answer to God for how he uses it. Secondly, it makes the subjects more obedient. But thirdly, it makes them more obedient because they're not obeying just a man, but they're obeying God. And thirdly, it sets limits. It's not an unlimited obedience of man to their ruler. It's an obedience limited by what is inside and what is outside the will of God. The Pope has authority within tradition. Within tradition to give orders. The Pope, often the question is asked about the new Mass. Did Pope Paul VI have authority to make a new Mass? And the answer is, within a new Mass, within tradition, yes. Outside of tradition, no. What he did was outside of tradition, therefore he had no right to make the new Mass, he had no right. He could have made a new Mass, which stayed inside tradition. But anybody who wants to stay inside tradition will not change the Tridentine Mass. Reuben. If he commands against God, yes.
Which, in that case, that was stopped.
Yes. Yes. Paul VI did not have authority from God to impose the new Mass upon the Catholic Church.
The question was, does he lose authority overall?
No. No, he loses authority to the Pope. Paul VI was Pope. He had authority to give all commands within tradition. But something like the Novus Ordo Mass, going outside of tradition, he had no authority.
But that doesn't make him not.
No. Okay. So that's an interesting paragraph. Read 15 when you get to it. As for princes, this doctrine places political leaders squarely before their grave responsibilities. So the doctrine makes the ruled more obedient, it makes it easier for the ruled to obey. It makes it easier for the rulers to behave themselves. Because scripture says you will be especially gravely judged. I think it's in the book, one of the Sapiential books. The book of, I'm not sure which, Proverbs or Ecclesiasticus, one of those. The rulers are placed squarely before their grave responsibilities. And so, 17, by this doctrine of all authority coming from God, the rights and interests of both rulers and ruled are harmoniously secured. And the problem of authority and liberty is hugely solved when you bring God into it and the fact that authority comes from God. Liberty, yes, authority, the whole problem takes on a quite different aspect, a quite different complexion, when you put God behind, and God above, and God behind and above authority, and above all men, rulers and ruled alike. So, the church's practice. Pagan Rome, the Middle Ages, modern times, three stages. The primitive church under pagan Rome taught strict civic obedience. You've got that in the epistle, we just said, in the epistles of Peter and the epistles of Paul. They're under the Romans. Strict obedience to the civil authorities. And therefore, 19, the early Christians did everything required by the laws of pagan Rome and more, except abandon the faith and displease God. And so the early Christians obeyed even the emperors in everything except what was outside the laws of God. They would not burn incense to strange gods. But they would allow the emperor. The famous example is St. Maurice, who in what's today Switzerland, with his whole legion, allowed himself to be executed with his whole legion because they would not burn incense. They were in the army of the Roman emperor. And the emperor required of them to burn incense. They said, no, we can't do that. We can't take part in the worship of false gods. We will go to the death for your majesty. We will serve the Roman Empire. We will fight as soldiers. We will fight bravely. We will die for the Roman Empire as soldiers. But we will not sacrifice to strange gods. And so the emperor said, well, I'm going to execute all of you one by one. Go right ahead. And he executed the whole legion. And the Christians, who it was a fight, it was a legion of fighting men. They submitted to being executed one by one by one. Steadily decimated, one tenth of every tenth soldier again, and then every tenth soldier, until they were all executed. They rather submitted than disobey the emperor, but they would not disobey God in order to obey the emperor. So they did not, and that's a classic example of the Christian civic obedience, obedience to the civil authorities, obedience to the state in action. Today, of course, can you imagine a Hollywood movie praising these soldiers for submitting to authority like that? Notice how in many of the Hollywood movies, the villain is the authority figure. Very often. And the hero is the one who's revolting, or who's in revolution, who's stirring up some kind of revolt.
Can you make a comment on Newton on the Bounty?
A British ship. in extreme circumstances, says the church, revolution is justified. But it's instead of the revolution is not justified as a principle, like by Thomas Jefferson. It's obedience which is the principle, and which is the exception. In Hollywood, revolution is the principle, and obedience is the exception. Things here have been turned around from how they were up there. Because of revolution. There's been a revolution, and therefore ideas are exactly the opposite of what they were. So, as I say, in fairness and in truth, Thomas Jefferson has, along with his bad principles, a good amount of good sense. And so he says, and undoubtedly in practice he says, you're not going to overthrow the government if it's only a little affair. So you see, in the end, the two things might coincide, but it's very different how you get to that middle point. If you see what I'm saying? Yeah. It's very different if you start out from revolution is justified, except if it's only a small thing. From revolution is not justified unless it's a big thing. That's a very different starting point. So, the early Christians did everything required by pagans. For instance, the sound of music. The mother, the kitten, the little kitten, is in revolt against the strictness of the Austrian Navy officer who pipes, and he's presented as ridiculous. He's presented as blowing a whistle in order to get the kids to do this and that and the other. And then in she comes, and she's cute and sweet, and she's in revolt. And she wins. She's the sympathetic one, and she wins. She's not a mother. She's an SEX kitten in that movie, correct? There's nothing motherly about the way she deals with those children. It's all, I'm a friend, and you're a friend, and we're all dancing around, and we're all sweet and cute. That's not a family. But that's the ideal put by that film. And it's an ideal of revolt. If you think about it, it's an ideal of revolt. She's in revolt against the order of the Austrian officer, which is presented as exaggerated and ridiculous. In other words, revolution is right unless, et cetera, et cetera. The principle is constantly pushed, revolution is good, revolution is right. And it's sad. It's sad. On the HMS Bounty, I think the captain was a real SOB. But notice that the officers under him, the revolt didn't come to much good. They stayed on the island. They landed on this island and stayed on the island because, of course, the British Navy would have come down on the mutineers very hard, right? And the American Navy would have come down hard on mutineers. Because you can't run a navy with disobedience. You can't run an air force or an army with disobedience. When you've got to get men to go and fight, which is something they don't want to do, you've got to have strong discipline. In the in the Vietnam War, apparently, you know, the soldiers were shooting their officers. That's something that happened in the Vietnam War. It's presented so in Oliver Stone's Platoon and elsewhere, I think, and things are really breaking down when that happens. So they didn't... Gosh, you can't... it's almost the end of the end of the American army if that was going on. And if that goes on the next time round, the American army is in real trouble. And it's because, why is it? Because they didn't enough, the officers and or the men did not enough believe in the Vietnam War. So, the primitive church taught strict obedience, and so the early Christians did everything required by pagan Rome's laws and more, except abandon the faith and displease God, and even then, they did not revolt. Even when they refused to displease God, they would not revolt against the emperor, but they would rather submit to being executed than disobey the emperor. When in the Middle Ages, when when Christ has conquered the Roman Empire, we have the 1,000 years from about 500 to 1500. In the Middle Ages, when the Christians became rulers, the church invested them with great authority. The church backed the kings and lent, put its authority behind the kings at the same time as it told the kings very strictly to behave themselves. It's interesting to read the churches in the pontifical, which is the book of prayers of the bishop, so to speak, the book of ceremonies of the bishop. It's interesting to read this ceremonial for the crowning of a king, for the consecrating of a king. And the church used to consecrate kings. The kings used to go through a religious ceremony in which they were anointed to demonstrate in front of the people, of course, in a very solemn ceremony, to put the authority of God behind the ruler. Not in order that the ruler can then crush his people. On the contrary, during the ceremony, the ruler, the king, is told, you better behave yourself, you better behave yourself, you've got to look after your people, you've got to protect the faith, you've got to do everything to get your subjects to get to heaven. That's your first duty, and you must swear to do that. And the king in the ceremony, the king has to swear that he will look after his subjects. So that the church is adjusting the whole problem. The church is not for the rulers against the ruled. It's not for the ruled against the rulers. The church is for everybody getting to heaven and the synchronization of rulers and ruled in order to achieve that. Similarly with the marriage, obviously. With a marriage, the church is not for Romeo against Juliet. And a priest who's got his head on his shoulders will never be for Romeo against Juliet, nor for Juliet against Romeo. He will always be a priest, if it's a valid marriage, a valid Catholic marriage, he will be for Romeo and Juliet, it's spelled as one word, either against Romeo or against Juliet. If Romeo is trying to break it up, he's going to be for Romeo and Juliet against Romeo. If Juliet is trying to pop, he'll be for Romeo and Juliet against Juliet. He's not for one against the other. He's for the marriage against either of them that wants to try to break it up. That's another problem, but it's a similar... The way in which then the wisdom of the church handles a marriage is a family is parallel to the wisdom with which it handles society. The individual, family, society. There are always those three layers, if you like. And the church consecrated political power by the union of church and state, says Leo XIII, to the great gain of both. Now, of course, the modern ideal is the separation of church and state. But the Catholic Church is for the union of the Catholic Church and state, not for the union of any church and state. It's for the union of the Catholic Church and the state, to the great gain of both. Let me suggest to you that you see the union of church and state happening naturally on the streets. You may say, I can't believe in the union of church and state. I suggest to you it happens naturally on the streets. There are problems when the policeman is going to pull in the parish priest. But the policeman gets a call from a house where the husband and wife are about to shoot one another. But he knows they're Catholic, so he says, the policeman rings up the parish priest, look, Father, I've got this hell of a problem in this house, they're about to shoot one another. Do you mind if you go in and have a look, and try to look after this? Father priest will say, yeah, I will. Because as a priest, he's got much more chance of being able to adjust the couple than a policeman. A policeman is going in there with the force of the state, the priest is going in there with the counsel of the church. On the other hand, if the priest is has some kind of unruliness or riot going on in his church, he rings up the police and says, look, sheriff, could you kindly come in with a couple of men and stop these troublemakers in the church? And again, the sheriff will be, at street level, the sheriff can be perfectly happy to do it. And there you've got, in practical terms, on street level, how the usefulness and naturalness of the union of church and state. It's perfectly, the priest looks after the spiritual domain, the police and the state look after the material and physical domain. The two are meant to fit together. They're not meant to be fighting one another. How can the modern world, how can this poor world have got to the point of believing in the separation of church and state? Well, again, it's after Protestantism. Because what happens with Protestantism, this is John Locke, what happens with Protestantism is that the Protestants say the Catholics are wrong, the Catholics say the Protestants are wrong, and of course, you and I know that if anybody really sat down and studied it, he should come up with the conclusion that the Catholics are right and the Protestants are wrong. But he says, I don't know, I can't have the state serving two churches at once. All I can do, I can't have the state united with two churches at once. I'll have to back off the question. So, better separation of church and state than to unite the state with one church which is going to put it at enmity with all of the others. The United States began in this situation of a number of different religions, and so it's understandable that the United States started on a principle of religious liberty. But as I say, it's understandable that somebody should make stairs out of sand if sand is the only material he's got. But sand is not going to stand up to it when you start walking up and down. It's understandable that you should build a nation on religious liberty if that's what you have to do because you've got people of different religions. But don't be surprised if down the pike people despise ideas and finish up despising all religion. If you begin by having to accept that all religions are as good as one another, you're laying down a principle at the end of the line is bound to be the discrediting of all religion. If you build the stairs of sand, the end of the line is bound to be that it's not going to stand up when you walk on it. Sand can't stand up to being walked on. And religion can't stand up, the true religion can't stand up to being put alongside false religions. So, and if you even put just all false religions alongside one another, they all discredit one another, you're going to discredit religion altogether. That's what happens. You see, from here onwards, the problems begin to be insoluble because people are leaving behind the church. And so when they leave behind the church, when they break from the church, the problems get more and more insoluble. And now today we're in a situation in which, you know, the situation around us, anybody who's got eyes in his head can see no human solution. Cardinal Ratzinger years ago said, there's no human solution. He was speaking about the problems inside the church. It's out of control. And the ideas, with the ideas that people have in their heads today, with the beliefs that people have today, beliefs of Freemasonry and communism and even further down, there's no way Humpty Dumpty can be put together again. Yes.
I think that there's a sense in people that they recognize how bad the state of the world is becoming, all the perverseness of it, and they don't want that to happen. So what I've noticed just in my life is that the people that I've come in contact with, the first person that actually does take time with them, if they worship pre-Trump environmentalists, that becomes their thing they cling on to. If the father doesn't love the mother clings on to the garden, or like in the case of some of my friends, grew up Catholic, but his mother decided it wasn't proper anymore for some reason. So he felt, as in my opinion, he felt loved to go where his mother went. So when his mother finally gave him the attention, she was involved in Presbyterians, so he went away with Presbyterians.
Yeah.
Like when someone's given a chance, no matter what it is, they're just happy that they got a chance and they see how many this could change.
True. What you're saying is that people, anybody who takes time, with somebody else's problem is liable today to be able to draw them to their solution. I think that's true. But of course that doesn't ease the confusion. Because the confusion is only solvable by the truth. Because the only real unity can be in the truth. Any other unity is unstable. Is as unstable as lies. And so the only possible stable solution to what's going on today is the reestablishment of the truth. The truth will make you free, says our Lord. And all of these untruths will make people, imprison people in confusion and error. And that, of course, is what's happening. So I'm sure that the people who have the truth should take time with everybody else, but there aren't that many people today who've still got hold of the truth. You're lucky to run into somebody with the truth, but be careful of somebody tomorrow taking twice as much time with you to make you into a Mormon, because if they give you twice as much tender loving care, off you will go. Okay, you've hooked onto something different from tender loving care. All right, it may have been tender loving care that got you here. But I hope that it's going to be something quite different that's going to hold you. Okay. The church invests in religious authority and consecrated political power by the union of church and state to the great gain of both. And that's what the church teaches. The state has a great deal to gain from the church backing its authority. And Catholics will generally back authority on principle. They will back authority in any situation. I can remember once at the seminary, this was when I was teaching in a cone under the Archbishop. The Archbishop was still around. And I can remember once how I went to him behind the back. I was number two at the seminary. I went to him behind the back of number one for a particular reason. Boy, did he receive me frostily. Ooh, the ice was in the air as he listened to me saying, complaining about something behind the back of number one. Ooh. Finally, though, he could see why I had done that. And then, of course, the ice melted. What I was doing was perhaps objectively justified. I was not subverting number one. I was simply taking what seemed to need to be taken to the Archbishop. And I couldn't do it through number one, so I was going around number one to do it. But until the Archbishop understood, wow, because he instinctively feared that I was subverting authority, and he wouldn't stand for it. He would not stand for it. And that's the Catholic reaction, to back authority. Not absolutely regardless, no, but because authority can be wrong, and you don't back authority when it is wrong, unless it's in something small. In which case you let it ride, as Jefferson says, as the Declaration of Independence says. But a Catholic will, as a matter of principle, back authority, whereas a modern man will almost, as a matter of principle, back the rebel. And you see, and again, when civilization is in good shape, the 1,000 years from 500 to 1500, of course you will normally back authority. When civilization is bad shape, it's understandable that the rebels are often right. When civilization is in bad shape, it's not so easy to automatically back authority, because here authority is going wrong. And so the rebel is often right. But you can't still make a principle of approving a rebellion. You can't rebuild society on a principle of approving rebellion. The society won't fly. And that's what they're trying to do today. To build society on a basis of revolution, you can't do it. So, the state gains by the church backing it. The church gains because the state will align its laws on the thinking of the church, and when it does that, it's going to use all the power of the state to make it easier to save one's soul, and that is considerable. That's a considerable help. If the state uses the police to shut down pornography, for instance, if the police moved, which here in the United States the police used to do until quite recently, pornography was a horror, it was treated like a horror, and the police clamped down on it. And that's common sense. And when the police do that, then the state is serving the salvation of souls. And the state can do a great deal for the salvation of souls in that way. And so the state can serve the church as the church can serve the state. And therefore church and state should be working together. They shouldn't have to be separate. And there shouldn't be a principle of separating them. Again, not at street level, but at White House level, I guess it's because of the number of Catholic voters, but the President of the United States usually has some Catholic priest or bishop who he knows and who he talks to and who he listens to, usually. I say that may be purely politics, but again, what you've got there is the re-emerging, at least a contact between church and state, which is common sense, which is sheer common sense. On the contrary, 23, the modern theories subvert all authority and ruin society. The modern theories, whereby revolution is right, except in small cases, the modern theories subvert all authority and ruin society because then only fear remains to coerce men. If you destroy authority, if you undermine authority, if you make the rebel always look good, then the only way you can control men is by fear, and that's the police and prison. So, and fear is a very unstable basis for society. In Latin America, the Spaniards and the Portuguese, or the Spaniards governed all of those Spanish nations. The Catholic Spain created a rosary of Catholic nations. Argentine, Chile, these are all Catholic nations. Uruguay, what is that? Paraguay, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, Panama, Guatemala, Mexico, Guatemala, then there are Salvador, Costa Rica, all different Catholic nations created by Spain. I said the other day that there have been few wars of any importance at all, but amongst those nations. And the Spanish Empire, when Spain was Catholic, ran the whole thing with about 10,000 soldiers. That's all it needed. Why? It didn't need force because of the priests and the missionaries. If I use that horribly politically incorrect word, the native South Americans were quite happy to obey the Spanish authorities because they could see that they were going to go to heaven. The Spaniards were there not just in order to get gold or to make themselves rich. The Spaniards were obviously looking after their souls and helping them to get to heaven. And so the Spaniards didn't need the great police force. Today, every single president in the United States has to increase the police force, correct? He has to put up the number of police and build new prisons. Because the people are more and more out of control, because there's less and less inner religion. And there's more and more admiration of the principle of revolt. There's more and more in the schools and in the movies, revolt and revolution are praised. And the children, the boys, naturally, they look like rebels, they behave like rebels. You tell them that they've got to wear a baseball cap on front, with the front in front, they'll wear it with the front at the back. They've even tried wearing, you know, trousers are normally one front and back, with the back at the back. They've even tried wearing trousers with the back to the front as well, but there's a problem with that. So that... I don't think that worked very long. But you tell modern boys, you know, that this is how it's done, this is the way they do it, and you and I know how they are, they will immediately try to do it a different way. And they will all try to do it a different way, so that they will all be conformists in non-conformity. And so you come straight back to the social nature of man, they're all rebels. Say that again. They're all rebels. How can they all be rebels? Well, they manage it in a way, they do it in a way they do it. So. Hence, conclusion, the popes and the church, numerous popes have urged rulers to rely on the church and to lean on the church, and I do so now. So he's saying, for goodness sakes, don't rely on Freemasonry. Don't persecute the church in your states. For goodness sakes, look after the Catholic Church and help the Catholic Church, and you will be repaid more than you can imagine. It will do your state enormous good. So rely and lean on the church. Because the Catholic Church, 26, is equally good to rulers and to ruled alike, for reasons given above. And so make sure that men understand and practice Catholic teaching on government and obedience for these intentions, etc. So, let us look at paragraphs 4, 5, 6, 7, the errors, which are very common today. This is naturalism. Government authority, 4, 5, 6, 7. Page 41 is right. The need for authority. Although man, when excited by a certain arrogance and contumacy, that's boldness, insolence, has often striven to cast aside the reins of authority, he has never yet been able to arrive at the state of obeying no one. In every association and community of men, necessity itself compels that some should hold preeminence. It's in the nature of any society, it's got to have a chief. Lest society, deprived of a prince of head or head by which it is ruled, should come to dissolution and be prevented from attaining the end for which it was created and instituted. But if it was not possible that political power should be removed from the midst of states, it is certain that men have used every art to take away its influence and to lessen its majesty, as was especially the case in the 16th century, when a fatal novelty of opinions infatuated many. So today's problem predates the United States of America. It's not America that's alone rebellious and so on and so on, or revolutionary. It's Protestantism. The problem goes essentially back to Protestantism. Since that epoch, not only has the multitude striven after a liberty greater than is just, but it has seen fit to fashion the origin and construction of the civil society of men in accordance with its own will. In other words, the modern times try to pretend that society is not, that doesn't have the nature that it has. Again, the attempt to change nature and to change the nature, the social nature of man, to pretend that man is not social by nature but individualistic by nature. Five, the error on power. Indeed, very many men of more recent times, walking in the footsteps of those who in a former age assumed to themselves the name of philosophers. Leo XIII keeps on saying that those 18th century philosophers, Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, D'Alembert, Condorcet, says they're not real philosophers at all. They were rebels. They were Masonic rebels. So those who call themselves philosophers say that all power comes from the people. So that the people, the men who exercise power in the state, do so not as their own, but as delegated to them by their people. And that by this rule it can be revoked by the will of the very people by whom it was delegated. That's the principle expressed in the Declaration of Independence. Here it is. I think I read it earlier. One moment. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted amongst men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That's it. That's the problem. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and so to institute new government. Unless, he says, prudence indeed will dictate the governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. In other words, the common sense comes kicking back. But the common sense only comes after a very false principle. The common sense, as often with the English have bad principles. Ever since the English became Protestants, they've had bad principles. But the English do still have some common sense. And so the reason why England has not completely destroyed itself with its rotten principles, Protestant principles, is because good sense has kicked in and moderated those Protestant principles, those wrong principles. There's, I think, something similar with the United States. But from these, Catholics dissent who affirm that the right to rule is from God as from a natural and necessary principle. The right to rule comes from God necessarily. And that limits what the ruler can tell the ruled. Six. It is of importance, however, to remark in this place that those who may be placed over the state may, in certain cases, be chosen by the will and decision of the multitude without opposition to or impugning of the Catholic doctrine. There's nothing wrong with the people choosing the leader or choosing their president. And by this choice, in truth, the ruler is designated, but the rights of ruling are not thereby conferred. The people give him the position, but they do not give him his authority. Nor is the authority delegated to him, but the person by whom it is to be exercised is determined upon. The people fix who is going to receive the authority from above. Finally, choice of government by the people. There is no question here respecting forms of government. Monarchy, democracy, or aristocracy. Monarchy, rule of one. Aristocracy, rule of a few. Democracy, rule of the people. There is no question here respecting forms of government, for there is no reason why the church should not approve of the chief power being held by one man or by more, provided only it be just and that it tend to the common advantage. It's not a question of systems, it's a question of justice. Justice and the common good. If the common good is looked after by a king, no problem. If the common good is looked after by an aristocracy, no problem. If the common good is looked after by the people, no problem. So it's not a question of king or, that's a secondary question, king or aristocracy or people. What matters is justice and the common good. Wherefore, as long as justice is respected, the people are not hindered from choosing for themselves that form of government which suits best either their own disposition or the institutions and customs of their ancestors. In other words, a people does not have to be democratic. And this is one great mistake of the United States. The United States insists on it, does everything it can to install in all the rest of the world what it considers to be democracy. That's not right. It's not wise and it's not right. It's not Catholic in any case. It's not Catholic. Because the United States' idea of democracy is precisely the sovereignty of the people, which is not a Catholic idea. The people, the authority coming from the people, that's the modern idea of democracy. And it's not the Catholic idea of democracy. So it's a mistake of the United States to want to push this kind of democracy everywhere. So in truth, eight, as regards political power, the church rightly teaches that it comes from God. Because the authority coming from God is clearly testified in the sacred scriptures and in the monuments of antiquity, the documents of the church fathers. Besides, no other doctrine can be conceived which is more agreeable to reason or more in accord with the safety of both princes and peoples. This doctrine harmonizes prince and people, ruler and ruled. Just like the Catholic doctrine of marriage harmonizes husband and wife while respecting the quite different character of husband and wife. Whereas the modern idea of marriage, just like the modern idea, is exactly parallel with the modern era on society, the modern idea of marriage is to make husband and wife exactly equal and interchangeable partners, as though one could just as well stay at home and look after the kids as the other, one can just as well go out in the world and slug everybody else as the other. No. The man is designed to go out of the home and slug and get slugged. That's a man's business. The woman is designed to stay at home and look after the children and look after the home. And women are gifted for that. Women are gifted to stay at home and men are gifted to go out and fight. Heaven help us from men who are not ready to fight. Heaven help us from women who want to do nothing less, nothing else. Because they, such women are a plague. Oof, yeah, that's right. But again, the whole of modern society is pushing in that direction. In our dear little Winona newspaper, at certain times of the year, day after day, there are photographs of the local girls in the local schools fighting one another, slugging, punching, kicking on the miserable basketball court to get at that miserable ball. I mean, really? You know, here they are, they're dressed like, they're dressed to look ugly. I mean, these are young girls. They're dressed to look masculine and ugly. And there they are looking masculine and ugly because they're fighting one another to get that wretched ball. What kind of mothers are these girls going to make? What kind of mothers? Yeah. What kind of mothers are they going to be for their children? The truth is they're not going to be interested in children. They won't have any sense for children. And so no wonder they are bought. And no wonder the poor kids that they do have are completely crazy and mixed up. Because they've never had a mother. They've had a basketball player. They've not had a mother. They've had a bad imitation male. They've had no female to look after them. They had a bad imitation male. And day after day. And this ideal of sports is pushed at these girls. And so the girls are obviously obliged to try to pretend to be boys. And you see the girls, they behave like that, they look like that. Wow, where's femininity gone? And with no femininity, where is motherhood going to be? So again, the modern world is completely wrong about the family, and the modern world is completely wrong about society, because the modern world is leveling everything down, is destroying hierarchy. In God's plan for the family, the man is the head. The man is the head. The woman is the heart. Woman has got qualities of the heart that we men don't have. She's got an intuition. She's got a sensitivity. She's got a flair for people. Women are people thing. People beings. Men are things beings. We're interested in motor cars and climbing mountains and, you know, things, cameras and all of this. Women are interested in people. You put any two women together and normally they will be talking about people. And they like talking. they like talking. But yeah, what do they like talking about? They like talking about people. People are their business. Because God wants them to look after the children and to look after their husband. And they need to be skilled around their husband. You know, somebody's got to... there's a Russian proverb... The wife is to the husband like the plant is to the, like the tomato is to the steak. So the wife is meant to, the man is meant to stand there straight and stiff like a steak, and the woman is meant to wrap herself around him like the plant wraps herself around a steak. Imagine if you have two plants and no steak. They're both in the mud. And today's men do not do that. They do not stand for anything. And so the women have got nothing to wrap themselves around. And so the women try to turn into men because the men aren't men. Why are the men not men? Because of all of these wretched modern doctrines which take the stuffing out of the men and leave them only rebels against anything good, automatic rebels. That's the one principle they've got in is rebellion. How can you make a father who's just a rebel? The moment he's got a family, he's going to rebel against it. I think I notice in the airports all the time, you know, you can see, it's obviously a husband and wife and two children, and you can see the father, you can watch him behaving in such a way as to push away his wife and children, because he's a rugged individualist and he's a rebel, and he stands on his own feet, and he doesn't want the wife and children hanging around. And the wife keeps coming back towards him, and she gets pushed, like being pushed away. Obviously, it's not every family, but you can watch it. And the children likewise need their father and come towards him, and he's sort of trying to be individualistic. If you've got an individualist, if the individual is everything, and that again goes back to Protestantism, if the individual is everything, what's going to happen to the family? What's going to happen to the society? They both fall to pieces. That's what we've got today. So there's a great parallel between what's happening to the family, what's happening to society. And if society goes wrong, it tends to pull the family apart. And if the family goes wrong, it pulls society apart. The Catholic Church would put all of these things together again, according to God's plan, which is hierarchy, with the husband and then the wife beneath him and the children beneath them both. 1, 2, 3. And the husband is the head and the wife is the heart. And the husband, his authority means that he will look after his wife. He will love her. That's what St. Paul says. Husbands, cherish your wives. Look after them. Love them. Whereas wives, St. Paul says, obey your husbands. Similarly, rulers, look after your ruled. Otherwise you will answer to God for it. Ruled, obey your rulers. There's an entire parallel. And just as the modern world doesn't understand the family, it doesn't understand society. The Catholic Church understands both. And these pagans that have got, that disappeared off the board now, but those pagans understood these elementary truths better than these pagans. Because these pagans, at least they hadn't apostatized from Christ. They hadn't turned away from Christ. Even down here, they hadn't yet turned from Christ, because he hadn't yet come so that nobody knew him. The post-Christian pagans are worse than the pre-Christian pagans, you could safely say. So, political power comes from God. Turn to, look at 11. It's a crucial argument. 9 and 10 are the arguments of authority from the scripture and from the church fathers. 11 is the argument of reason. Indeed, nature, or rather God, who is the author of nature, wills that man should live in a civil society, and this is clearly shown both by the faculty of language, the greatest medium of intercourse, of intercourse amongst men, and by numerous innate desires of the mind, and the many necessary things and things of great importance, which men by themselves cannot get hold of, but which they can get hold of when they're joined and associated with others. I could never make myself a pair of shoes. I couldn't repair my own car. There's 1,000 things I couldn't do, and I need other people to do. What I can do is talk. But now, a society can neither exist nor be conceived in which there is no one to govern the wills of individuals. So he says, one, men are social by God's design. Two, society needs authority. And therefore, three, authority comes from God. A society can neither exist nor be conceived in which there is no one to govern the wills of individuals in such a way as to make, as it were, one will out of many and to impel them rightly and in orderly fashion to the common good. Therefore, God has willed that in a civil society there should be some to rule the multitude. Rulers and ruled is the will of God. It's not just the desire of men, which is the modern attitude. Government in itself is not unnatural. On the contrary, government in itself is natural. The Americans tend to think government in itself is automatically a bad thing. All government must be checked, held in check. Again, with common sense, holding those principles, you'll fall back on your feet to quite an extent, but the principle is nevertheless wrong. Common sense shouldn't have to come to the rescue of your principles. Common sense should be in line with your principles. Or your principles should be in line with common sense. Also, this is a powerful argument, that those by whose authority the state is administered must be able, this is his second argument. One, man is social. Socialness requires authority. Therefore, man coming from God, authority comes from God. Two, those by whose authority the state is administered must be able so to compel the citizens to obedience that it is clearly a sin of the latter not to obey. But no man has in himself or of himself the power of constraining the free will of others by fetters of authority of this kind. This power resides only in God, the creator and legislator of all things. And it is necessary that those who exercise it should do it as having received it from God. There is one lawgiver and judge that is able to destroy and deliver, says James. This is clearly seen in every kind of power. That which resides in priests comes from God is so acknowledged that among all nations the priests are recognized as and called the ministers of God. In like manner, the authority of fathers of families preserves a certain impressed image and form of the authority which is of God, of whom all paternal fatherhood in heaven and earth is named. But in this way, different kinds of authority have between them wonderful resemblances, since whatever there is of government and authority, its origin is derived from one and the same creator and Lord of the world, who is God. So all authority, if you like, is a kind of fatherhood. All fatherhood comes from God. All authority comes from God. So you can see the Pope arguing, giving arguments of reason from the way things are, from nature. But the appeal to the way things are doesn't fly today. You say to somebody today, this is the way things are, and what will his reaction be? Well, I'm going to make them different. Or I don't see why they should be like that for me. Or why don't we try something different? Or I'm going to change it. Yes. And the impulse is to change nature. You announce to somebody that this is every given is a prison. Every given is a prison. That's the modern world. For the Catholic, no, every given is, if it is a given, it's most likely to come from God. It'll belong to nature, and nature comes from God. So givens come from God. Free consent, not the source of authority. This is 12, and then we'll look at 17. Those who believe civil society had risen from the free consent of men, looking for the origin of its authority from the same source, say that each individual has given up something of his right, and that voluntarily every person has put himself into the power of the one man in whose person the whole of those rights has been centered. That's the modern theory, Rousseau in particular. But it is a great error not to see what is clear, that men, as they are not a nomad race, a wandering race, have been created without their own free will for a natural community of life to live together. It is plain, moreover, that the agreement which these modern philosophers allege is openly a falsehood and a fiction, and it has no authority to confer on political power such great force, dignity, and firmness as the safety of the state and the common good of the citizens require. In other words, government by consent just hasn't got any clout. Because the moment I take away my consent, I take away the government. Then only will the government have all those ornaments and guarantees when government is understood to emanate from God as its august and most sacred source. So for men to obey, they need to feel that the authority has something divine about it. Famous line in one of the Shakespeare plays, "There is a divinity doth hedge about a king." I forget which it is. Well, enough. Other questions? Yes.
Any of the Vatican II popes after that, have any of them ever referred back to these encyclicals?
That's a good question. Good question. Do the recent popes refer to these encyclicals? And the answer is no. No, no. They refer to one another. So John Paul will frequently quote himself, John Paul II, frequently. Well, his collected works are already like that, so it's, you know. He produces so much that he's got plenty to quote from. He will frequently quote himself. He will quote Paul VI, John the 23rd perhaps, but he rarely quotes these. The same with Paul VI. He did not often quote, because they've got a new doctrine, and therefore they don't refer back to this unless by chance their doctrine coincides, then they will go, but no. And that's one of the things that's noticeable about the documents of Vatican II is how everything new in those documents does not lean on what went before. It can't. It's a brand new doctrine.
You read these and often refer to our predecessor or devotee.
That's right.
Any number of times.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. These teachers are constantly saying, look behind you guys and you can see a line, a straight line, going all the way back to our Lord Jesus Christ. Or going all the way back to the New Testament. And they will quote the New Testament, they will quote the Church Fathers, they will quote the Middle-Aged theologians, they will quote the theologians of modern times, and it's all one straight line. And the Pope is constantly saying, like our Lord Jesus Christ, says, it's not my doctrine, I didn't invent this, it comes from my Father. I'm simply saying what my Father said to say. Similarly, the popes will keep on saying, it's not my doctrine, I'm simply saying what my predecessors have said. Look at this pope, that pope, that pope. This is what they all said. The modern popes can't say that. They can't do that because they're out of line. This pope praises Luther, and with reason. And Ratzinger will praise the ideas of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity, saying that what we're doing today is Christianizing these ideas. So these popes recognize that they're in this line. Of course, they have to do it with a little care because it's not apparently Catholic. But these, Archbishop Lefebvre said, I'm not teaching you anything of mine. He seems to say to his seminarians, look, I'm simply teaching you what the Church says. If you find me teaching you something that is not what the Church says, leave. Get away from me. That's how the Archbishop spoke. And it's how a Catholic speaks. I didn't invent this doctrine. I'm simply handing down what I received. And the saying that Archbishop Lefebvre wanted engraved on his tomb was that quotation from St. Paul. I've simply handed down what I received. He was at the French seminary in Rome. He always used to say he had a great teacher there, Father Laflock. And Father Laflock taught the encyclicals. And the Archbishop says, that's it. This is it. By some strange, what can you say? By some diabolical disorientation, the mass of bishops of Vatican II had lost their grip on this doctrine. to the point that they did not recognize that the new doctrine is exactly out of line with that. They simply looked at the white cassock and the red cassock and they said, if you say so, okay. And then they played mental games in order to try to fit it all together. The archbishop said, you can't play mental games. The two things are out of line. So the new line cannot possibly play, you know, align itself on the old line. The new line aligns itself on the French Revolution and Luther. It can't do anything else. And of course, some of these say the modernists were hit too hard by Pius X. Pius X was unfair. Pius X didn't really understand them. They were good guys and so on and so on. Madness. Madness. Yes, Tony.
I'm just looking at that drawing up there. I keep looking at it, trying to reconcile something. My state motto is, under God, the people rule. So that would put the ruler outside the area where God is.
Under God, the people rule. If you understand...
himself would not be in that... that area, but he'd be outside of it.
Under God, the people rule. They're trying to have it both ways.
Yeah, and it doesn't. For years, I've tried to figure it out, but that's the first time it looks to me like the ruler that we choose then would be outside that.
Under God, the people rule.
Well, they just lift up that ruler.
Well, he's not up where he's supposed to be. He's under the people. They're receiving guidance from God.
Well, the saying is making the people into the ruler.
Right.
So what you're doing is you're wiping out all of this.
Okay. We've gotten the ruler.
But under God, that's good. But the people rule is a contradiction.
Right.
Because you can't have the ruler can't be the people almost by definition, because a society can't hold together by the majority of people saying what goes.
Well, where does the ruler go then?
The saying pretends that the people are the ruler. Under God, the people rule. It's pretending that the people are the ruler, but that's a pretense.
Yeah.
Because you could not have a football team in which 10 out of the 11 players were captain. You can't have a fire brigade in which 9 out of 10 firemen are the chief.
We're still trying to figure out where to put the ruler.
Well, it's trying to have it both ways, and you can't do it.
It's a saying, but the reality of the guy.
Yes. Yes.
Assuming you've got a Catholic society.
Yes.
Is there a point at which society can get too large? Or in God?
That's an interesting question. I'd have to think about that, but I don't think so. I don't think so, especially with modern means of communication. Because, of course, the nations have got bigger and bigger according as the means of communication have got. And now we've got absolutely global intercommunication, hence the push towards global government. And that global government could be Catholic, If it was Catholic, the authority would be devolved by what's called the principle of subsidiarity. The principle of subsidiarity is a Catholic principle. It's also a common sense principle. Catholicism is common sense and common sense is Catholic. It's a common sense principle whereby authority is pushed down to the lowest level possible. That's to say, possible while still remaining authority. In other words, the higher authority does not try to pull everything to itself. That's anti-subsidiarity. The principle of subsidiarity is that you delegate as far down as you reasonably can. That does not mean that the ruled become rulers, but it means that somebody on the shop floor decides shop questions. Somebody in the factory decides factory questions. Somebody in the economy decides economy questions, and somebody on the globe decides global questions. You have a series of layers of authority, and you get questions dealt with at the local level as far as possible. So I don't think that a global government is necessarily an un-Catholic. It could be Catholic, I think. But if it was Catholic, authority would immediately start going down and not be pulled up like it's happening today. Today, globalism is in the hands of the bad guys, and so it's difficult to imagine globalism being Catholic. But I don't think there's anything that would necessarily stop it. Would anybody disagree with that?
What if the modernists say that, well, Catholics don't believe, I'm just putting it there, I don't believe it, but what if the modernists come back and say, well, you Catholics don't believe in contraception, so the world would be overpopulated, you'd have too many kids. I could see them replying to his statement or something like that.
Yes. I don't think that Catholics would obviously... If the global government was Catholic, there would be no contraception. And the Catholics would rely upon God. God, this is your problem. You want us to have children. You don't want us to stop children. We will have children. We are threatened with overpopulation. Look after it. Because God is bound to look after the problem. The problems, in inverted commas, that come from obeying his law. He can't lay down a law and then the obedience to the law creates problems which he won't help you to solve. It's not possible. Who else? John.
Two things. This 1,000-year thing keeps coming up. And
yes.
Your picture is coming back to me. And in Revelation, they talk about 1,000 years. Could that 1,000-year, the years from 500 to 1,500, could that be the so-called...
Maybe, yes. Let's lift this one a little opposite. The question of the 1,000 years is not easy. Let's not go into it here, but Christendom did last plus or minus for 1,000 years. Okay? Next question.
And then the size of the Roman legion, you got 600 men?
Oh no, rather 6,000.
The time of Maurice, that would be after the Diocletian reform, so the legion had dropped to 1,200 men.
Only 1,200? I didn't know. Okay. He's talking...
Caesar was 5,000.
Okay.
But Diocletian reform...
Could easily be. He's talking about things I don't know about.
A lot.
Yes, it's still a lot. Yes.
For like 10 days.
I don't know how many they say, but it's very possible that it was around that. Yes.
This is sort of a risky question. But if communism didn't have anti-Catholic ideals, could it have not been one of the most efficient forms of government?
No. All depends how you define communism. But if you define communism as atheistic materialism,
if it didn't have anti-religious,
then it wouldn't be communism.
Then what form of government would it be then?
Anti-religion is intrinsic to communism.
Plus, it denies property rights, right?
It's socialist. Communism is against nature, uphill and downhill. Communism is false on God, on man, on family, on state. You name it, and the communist doctrine is contrary to nature. You've got it here, Herman. Atheistic communism. Turn to page. One moment. Page 309, 310, 311. Paragraph 10. Paragraph 9, materialism is his foundation. So it's against God. It's against anything spiritual. Paragraph 10, individual personality is destroyed. The man is destroyed. Paragraph 11, the family is destroyed. Paragraph 12, the civilization is destroyed. 13, the state is destroyed. These ideas, a summary, paragraph 14, all these ideas are contrary to reason and contrary to divine revelation.
So the main principle of communism is the complete abolition of religion?
Yes. Lenin said, God is my personal enemy. Oh yeah. And Marx was in revolt primarily against God. Communism is one huge revolt against God. So there's very little to praise in communism. Its principles are completely false. Again, if Russia, communist Russia, succeeded in surviving for a while, it's only because a certain common sense kicked in to stop the horrible principles being put into practice. An example, two examples. One, in the Spanish Civil War, as I said to you, Within a short space of time, the Spanish communists had re-established officers. They couldn't fight without officers. And that's an example of the motto of South Dakota, you know. And the officers are not going to be the majority. An officer is bound to be a minority, and then there's minority. Okay. One example of the reality coming back. And another example of reality coming back, when the communists took over in Russia, they declared free love. The result was such chaos that within a few years, the Russians were more strict about marriage than even your decadent West. Or they were as strict, the Russians were puritanical about marriage. But just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, when the Berlin Wall fell, the East Germans came flooding over to West Germany for the pornography. Which means to say that the communists were stricter against pornography than the decadent West. Which means to say that the communists were putting back in practice, without God, nature was obliging them to put back in practice certain sane principles in order to preserve their society. In other words, a communist society can only survive by disregarding its own principles. Just like American revolutionary society can only survive, it survives by its common sense, by what still survives of its common sense, and not by these revolutionary principles, that every rebel is a hero and every hero is a rebel. That's a recipe for complete disintegration.
The arrival of communism
and the survival of communism is a punishment from God.
I know that Chris just said that they were burying the West by corrupting the youth.
Yes.
And I believe that their rock music is largely part of that.
There's
a Marxist minstrel.
It's a good book by David Noble.
Yes, John Lennon was a guest of the Politburo.
Yes. The communists, there's no question that the communists have promoted and have infiltrated and promoted rock music in order to corrupt the Western youth. And they banned it in their own country. That figures. That what they ban in their own country, they promote in the West. The same with drugs. The communists, like the Jews, would only have the power that they have to corrupt the West if the West wasn't irreligious. If the West still had its religion, the communist and Jewish attacks would simply bounce off. So the main fault is not with the communists and Jews for the corruption of the West. The main fault is with the Westerners and the decadent Catholics. Yes?
Just another question. This might not be exactly proper, but in the new church of the Nouveau Sordo, as it falls outside the green pyramid.
Yes, the green parameters, yes.
As it falls outside, is it not itself becoming schismatic?
Yes. Archbishop Lefebvre said, the conciliar church excommunicates me, I never belonged to it. They can't excommunicate me because I was never in communion with them as conciliarists. And so that, I think that's the answer to your question. They have put themselves, these people have each time put themselves out of the church in simple terms. It's more difficult to try, you can't generalize. Therefore, Pope John Paul II is outside the church. Oh, gosh, you've got to be careful how you say things. But as a conciliarist, he's outside the church. All followers of the Council, of the Second Vatican Council, as followers of the novelties of the Second Vatican Council, are outside the church.
So isn't this type of action more or less doing the hokey-pokey? Putting your left foot in and your left foot out?
How do you mean?
Well, in one instance saying he's not outside of the church. In all other instances of the Nouveau Sordo, he is.
It's a difficult question. And we'd go on till 9 or 10 o'clock if we tried to disentangle it completely, okay? But, I mean, in brief, if you distill the pure idea of the conciliarism is absolutely outside the Catholic Church. The pure idea. But every conciliarist is a concrete human being who is still Catholic in part. Cardinal Ratzinger, John Paul II. John Paul II is against abortion, he's against divorce, he's against, okay? He's still Catholic in part. What is Catholic in him is not conciliarist, and what is conciliarist in him is not Catholic. But he is a mixture of the two. Is he as a whole, taken as a whole, inside or outside the church? Exactly. It's rather God's question, but I personally, because he is convinced that he is inside the church, I incline to say he's inside the church. Because he wants to be inside the church, he means to be inside the church, he thinks he's inside the church. A great deal of him is outside the church, I readily grant. But I wouldn't dare take upon myself to say he is outside the church. And if I went up to him and said, Holy Father, you're outside the church, he would laugh at me. Cardinal Ratzinger would just laugh at me. Laugh at you if you said that. They really mean to be working inside the church and for the church. They're completely deceived. But that is still what they mean. They are not like Luther saying, get lost into the Catholic Church. I'm outside the church and I want to be outside and I mean to be outside. That's not the case with these. We're in a different case. It's a hard case. There's no precedent. Never has the majority swung away. In each case, it was a minority. Here it makes it look as though it's a half. But there it's clearly the majority that's swinging out. Right?
St. Anastasius' plan, there was a majority. 400 back then.
They went Arian, yes. When the church came back on track, did all of those Arians stay outside, or did a number of them come back? I don't know the history of it. You've above all got to distinguish between concrete and abstract. If you purify the abstract idea, then it's as clear as black and white and night and day. But if you say that if you come to the concrete man, the greatest saint has still got sin in him, and the greatest sinner has still got something good in him. Therefore, there's no purely black or purely white amongst concrete human beings.
So, in taking such a position, the society can only make defensive statements.
I think that's true. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, but I think that's true without admitting that all we do is the hokey pokey. Yes, last question.
I would ask if there's any Catholic countries or communities, true Catholic societies in the world today.
No. The Vatican did its best to dissolve them. Paul VI stopped Franco from making Spain a Catholic state. Paul VI imposed on General Franco religious liberty, imposed upon Spain religious liberty. Franco said, I don't like this, I don't want this, but the Catholic Pope is telling me to make Spain un-Catholic. What can I do? What could he do? Same with Colombia, the same with the Valley. The Vatican has imposed upon the Catholic states to de-Catholicize themselves.
Are there communities where...
St. Mary's, Kansas. Nowhere in the conciliar church is properly Catholic today. There are slight communities coming together with the society, and not perhaps only with the society. I'm not just trying to be self-serving, but your best chance of finding a Catholic community is, I would say, with the society. Today, I would say, is with the society. Portugal is not in good shape. No. Our Lady said there the dogma of the faith would never be lost. But our priests, we've got a couple of priests in Portugal, we've had a couple of priests, they say the priests are terrible. The priests are terrible modernists, yes. Especially in the Basilica of Fatima, at the Shrine of Fatima. They're terrible modernists. It's to the point where it's mysterious. They ask themselves, what can Our Lady have meant by Portugal not losing the dogma? Because it looks as though the priests have lost it. Mysterious. Tomorrow, Rerum Novarum.